It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's a challenging question. What should happen when an inmate is deemed too dangerous to release back into society, but has served his or her sentence? Since 2007, New Hampshire inmates who are considered sexually violent predators have been eligible for what's known as civil commitment. Under the statute, the state can hold an inmate for an additional 5 years to seek treatment, and to do so, a team of experts must first determine that an inmate is likely to commit further crimes, and a prosecutor must prove before a jury that the inmate has a mental abnormality that makes him prone to reoffend. It's a deliberately high bar designed to deal with a small but dangerous group. But now, several years after the law was signed by Governor John Lynch, the civil commitment law is coming under criticism. Prosecutors worry their sentencing options are too limited and that funding to prosecute these cases can be hard to come by. Defense lawyers object to the notion of punishing people for crimes they might commit in the future, and they say certain types of more minor misbehavior in prison can lead some inmates to be designated for civil commitment. There have been calls for fine-tuning or reviewing the law, covering what seems to be unique ground in our system of criminal justice. Today on The Exchange, reviewing New Hampshire's sexual predator law, civil commitment, civil liberties, and public safety. And let's hear from you. Do you remember when this law was first put in place? Did you have concerns about it then? And what do you make about some of the debate now underway over potential changes to the law? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. Our guest for the hour, Anne Rice, Deputy Attorney General for New Hampshire. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for asking me.
Also, Tony Scalambrini is a New Hampshire public defender who typically defends inmates who are facing civil commitment in New Hampshire. And Tony Scalambrini, welcome to The Exchange to you.
Thanks, Brady.
And Michael Valentine, a prosecutor in Hillsborough County who handles civil commitment cases. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, Anne Rice, you were part of the group who crafted this law originally back in 2007. What was the idea behind pursuing civil commitment? Where did that come from?
Well, there is a recognition that there are some people who have committed sexually violent offenses that we see as repeat offenders. And there's a concern that a person may be incarcerated for a long time, but not really be ready for coming back out into society, that they may still pose a significant danger. And so the civil commitment statute was a recognition of this concern and offering another tool to protect the safety of people in the community from sexual offenses.
And we should specify that this is not necessarily for every person who is convicted of a crime. This is a particular group of inmates for particular kinds of crimes?
It's a very narrow group of people who have committed certain kinds of sexually violent offenses, including a homicide where there's a sexual angle to it, or a kidnapping, or a burglary. But it's very narrowly tailored. The person has to be shown to have a mental abnormality that causes them to have tendency to sexually offend.
Now, when we say that a person is being held for up to 5 years after a sentence, where is the place then that they're being held?
They're being held at the Secure Psychiatric Unit, which is a facility on the grounds of New Hampshire State Prison in Concord. It's a separate psychiatric facility that holds a number of different populations of people, one of which would be the people that have been civilly committed as sexually violent predators.
Michael Valentine, when does your office typically get involved in a case like this?
We get a referral when someone is about to be released from prison and has a qualifying sexual offense. So at this point, the Department of Corrections has set up a notification system that they don't particularly review. They don't particularly decide someone is additionally dangerous. They just say to us, this person has a qualifying sexual offense, and they leave it to us to start that review process.
And so then you would make a determination that you feel that this could be a person for civil commitment.
We do. We obviously look at our file. We try to get some more Department of Corrections records and maybe some other records that are available to make just an initial determination. The difficulty, of course, is that we're not experts in mental abnormalities or those sorts of predictions of risk. we're lawyers, so we're kind of looking at it as to just whether or not we think it's a case that should be referred. Then we refer it to what's called the multidisciplinary team, where a panel of experts actually gets to more thoroughly review the case.
Tony Scullambrini, what did you make of this law when it was first proposed, and has that changed at all in the years since it was passed?
Well, when it was passed in 2007, there was a conference where all of the judges and the prosecutors and the defense lawyers came. And the gentleman who was then the chief judge of the Superior Court, Justice Lin, he's now in the Supreme Court, he had brought up a point about, you know, like, how is this law going to work? You know, eventually we're going to get to the point where the people that have been charged with these sex offenses have sentences that are longer than they used to be. In the early 90s, they were not getting these very long sentences. And so is this law just going to phase out over time? So that was one of the things that everybody initially had a concern about. Like, how long is this going to stay relevant if we get in people that have, you know, 30 or 40 year sentences and they're 40 years old? They're not going to likely make it to the end of their sentence to be eligible. And then the second thing that we had a concern about was the sort of rigidity that was in place. There was, you know, like, I'm not sure if most people know this, but in the criminal justice system, vast percentages of cases, something like 90% of cases, get dealt away in plea bargains, and the law did not have any provision for plea bargaining or the equivalent. And so what's happened over time is that that's changed, and judges have sort of looked at the law, and compared it to the rules for Superior Court civil cases, and they've created mechanisms that have sort of tempered the rigidity of the law. But it has changed pretty dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years of how these cases go to trial, how they're prosecuted, how they're defended. And I don't think that anybody could have envisioned that in 2007.
Anne Rice, what was it that that led the state to pursue this particular approach to handling this kind of inmate, rather than, say, simply lengthening sentences for certain kinds of crimes? What made civil commitment a more appropriate option in the eyes of the law at that point?
Well, lengthening the sentences, I think there were a number of reasons why you wouldn't want to just overall lengthen sentences. There needs to be a process to identify the people that are appropriate for the kinds of civil commitment, and I'm not sure that just a sentencing provision would allow for that. That's what's so important about the multidisciplinary team in this process. This is a preventative type of legislation rather than sentencing, which is really imposing a sentence for an act that has already been committed. This is recognizing that some very small population is a danger in the future. So it's trying to be proactive in addressing those dangers.
But of course, as Michael Valentine pointed out, that's sort of a tricky business, trying to predict what may happen, whereas criminal justice typically looks at what has happened and tries to make a determination about what are the consequences.
Absolutely. And I think that the risk identification is an area of growing study and research. And I think it would be safe to say that that's one of the things that's hotly litigated in the civil commitment proceedings, is the issue of risk.
Now, there have been only a handful of cases in the state over the last 6 or 7 years. Does that, Michael Valentine, suggest that the law is working in that only a very select group winds up being considered for civil commitments?
Well, I think it depends on who you're asking. Obviously, asking the prosecutor, I think there could be additional people that would be appropriate, that could be referred. But even as prosecutors, we have tried to take a very narrow focused view on only selecting the most dangerous people that we know we're going to be able to prove in court are sexually violent predators. We obviously see lots of cases go across our desk and lots of cases that, because of their crime, might qualify for this offense, but we know right in advance that we're not going to be able to prove a mental abnormality, or we're not going to be able to prove a pattern of behavior that is appropriate for civil commitment.
So in a case like that, then, where you don't feel like civil commitment is either appropriate or can be proved that there's a need for it, what do you do then with an inmate then who's going to be released?
Well,
what can you do?
Well, then we have virtually nothing to do with it. You know, let's say in New Hampshire you get a prison sentence that has a minimum number and a maximum number. So let's say a person gets a 5 to 10 year prison sentence. if they do everything they're supposed to and they have gone through the programs and they've done the sexual offender treatment program, they will likely get paroled near that minimum sentence, and then they will be on a period of supervision. We don't get involved at that point. The parole board determines their conditions. They're supervised by the Department of Corrections, and we would have nothing to do with it unless they commit another crime. The only time we've been getting involved with civil commitments, and this is a change that we actually did institute specifically, a legislative change that we passed, I think, in 2009, was that it clarified we're only focusing on those people who are reaching their maximum sentences. And anybody who's being released prior to that on parole is sort of subject to the supervision and the restrictions put on the parole board, but not by the civil commitment system.
Tony, what do you make of this? Is the bar set in the right place here for cases of civil commitment?
Well, it's really hard to say if the bar is set in the right place because we've had such a small number of people go through the system that it doesn't give you a good sample size to judge whether it was set in the right place. I do have to say that the people that work for the multidisciplinary team, specifically Jeffrey Souther and the people that he has working for him, they do an incredibly thorough job of vetting these people. Part of this is you have essentially an expert grand jury. That's what the multidisciplinary team is the equivalent of. In the criminal system, the police get a charge. It goes to the county attorney. They present it to the grand jury. The grand jury says, yes, we think there's something here, or no, there's not. And then it goes forward to a trial where you get a different jury. In the sexual offender context, the multidisciplinary team sits as this gatekeeper expert grand jury, and they've done a really good job. But because there have been so few cases that come through the system, we don't really know where the hiccups are yet. I mean, if you're a state like California where they have thousands of people that go through the system, or if you're a state like Kansas where the law has been in place for a long time, since the late 90s, they have a better pattern of figuring out, is the bar set too high or is it set too low? I mean, if you have only 12 or 24 people that go through the system in 5 years, you could just have a bunch of hiccups. You could have, all sorts of random fluctuations that the small sample size doesn't really bear out.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, we're looking at New Hampshire's predator laws. We'll pick up after a short break, and we'd like to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Stay with us.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mike Danielli. NHPR earned 3 Edward R. Murrow Awards for Outstanding Journalism this year. You can hear the award-winning entries posted on our Inside NHPR blog at nhpr.org. Looks like beautiful weather all the way to the weekend. Today, sunshine, clear skies, highs in the lower 60s. Tonight, clear and cool, lows in the mid-30s. And then on Friday, partly sunny, highs in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling, offering tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork. Online at justcallheritage.com. And from New Hampshire Community Colleges, committed to increasing the number of science, technology, engineering, and math graduates in New Hampshire. ccsnh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today in The Exchange, we're reviewing New Hampshire's laws on predators. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, or you can send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. When a civil commitment case comes up, there's a multidisciplinary team established by the state that meets to examine the issues and make determinations. Joining us now is the chair of that team, Jeffrey Souther. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us in The Exchange.
It's a delightful to be here.
Can you first tell us who this multidisciplinary team consists of?
Yeah, the team by statute requires that it have either a licensed forensic psychologist or forensic psychiatrist or one of each. As it's turned out, the team always has 2 licensed psychologists and myself as chairperson.
And what is the process like then when a case comes to you?
Well, when I receive a referral from a county attorney, by law, we have 4 months to complete our work and issue a report to the county attorney so that they can go through a process to prosecute if we find the person meets the definition. So the first task is to, one, I appoint a team from my panel of experts. I work with the Department of Corrections to gather what can be up to 5,000-plus pages of documents from medical records to inmate records to sex offender treatment records, and we'll often get records from other institutions such as hospitals or psychiatric hospitals where a person may be. Once we have all those materials gathered, organized, the team meets face-to-face. We thoroughly review all the documents and then go through the process of deciding if the person meets the definition as a sexually violent predator or not.
And you have to all agree on that, if I'm understanding correctly.
We all need to agree. It has to be unanimous in our decision. So if any one of us disagrees, then the finding must be that the person does not meet the definition as a sexually violent predator. And that decision is final. It's nothing that a county attorney can appeal.
Now, the way you described it is that there's a definition in place of what a person would be defined as a sexually violent predator. So, but at the same time, you are trying to predict whether a person would offend again. Do you have to have a certain amount of certainty, or do the people on the team have to have a certain amount of certainty before approving someone for civil commitment?
Well, unlike other states, we don't have a percentage. We don't have to say the person that we have a degree of 51% certainty that the person will reoffend. What our job is to look at the prongs of the statute and say, first, does the person have a mental abnormality? And that is defined in statute simply saying that it's a person has something that's going to make them likely to engage in acts of sexual violence. Now, being mental health professionals, we don't look at the legal definition of mental abnormality. We look at the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual to see if they have some diagnosable mental illness, such as some type of sexual disorder or paraphilia. We look then to see, is that person likely to engage in an act of future sexual violence? And it's not whether it's going to happen in the next week or two or 6 months or 6 years. This is really a lifetime prevalence. And is that as a direct result of the mental abnormality or personality disorder? The hardest part of our work is trying to make that determination of likely. And we look at the entire life history. We look at their entire criminal history to get a good sense of the person. If granted, we will do a clinical interview with the individual, and we use what are recognized actuarial instruments, such as one that's called the Static 99R, which is the most utilized risk assessment instrument for determining if a person might be a risk to reoffend sexually.
And let me ask you this, because you talked about the statute referring to mental abnormalities and the idea of lifetime prevalence. The law says that the state could hold somebody in a civil commitment for 5 years, but if there's a feeling that there's a lifetime prevalence, is that the right framework for dealing with somebody who maybe treatment isn't really going to work for them?
Well, the law does allow the court to commit the person up to 5 years, and it also has the provision that if it is the determination of the court that the person continues to be a risk, continues to be likely to commit further acts of sexual violence, they can recommit them for up to another 5 years. And this is something clearly laid out in the statute of the process that they would have to go through. The hope is that the individual, while at the secure psychiatric unit, engages in treatment, has a better understanding of the disorder and their impulses, and is better able to manage those so that they can be released.
And one last question for you. Is the process working as it's set up now, or would you like to see changes?
Well, I think all three of your panelists said it well, that we don't have that much experience in the state, and it's certainly far less than Attorney General Rice and I and others thought we would have when we set this up in 2007. So it's too early to say, I think, if this is working as well as it could or not. I think what we've done as a team is look very carefully at every individual. It's a high bar to be found to be a sexually violent predator, and it should be because of the implications of civil liberty versus public safety. Changes, I think that there are others on your panel who can talk about that, but the one I would mention is that in other states, there is a pre-screening conducted whether by the Department of Corrections or by some other entity that takes a look and screens out and sends to the county attorneys just those individuals who are the highest risk. They then can decide to send it to a multidisciplinary team for a more complete review. That's something we just don't have in New Hampshire.
Well, Jeffrey Souther, I want to thank you for taking a little time with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jeffrey Souther, the chair of the state's multidisciplinary team, which evaluates cases of civil commitment. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire's predator laws. Well, many applauded the 2007 law, which allows offenders to be held after their sentences expire. Others point out that there are worrisome flaws in the law. We'd like to hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We do have some callers on the line, but first I wanted to give Michael Valentine a chance to respond to what Jeffrey Souther just said.
I just wanted to chime in, Brady, because Jeff brings up a good point that it is, as I think I sort of hinted at, it's a difficult process for us as prosecutors to make a medical kind of determination as to whether or not someone should be referred. And one of the things that we have talked about in various trainings, and I know Jeff has talked about with his team, is that if the Department of Corrections set up a system so that there was a decision made by medical professionals, by treatment providers, before it ever reached the county attorney, it would certainly help screen out those people that really don't need to be referred. And then the people that get evaluated by the MDT are really more likely to be those that we're specifically looking for.
Tony.
Michael's point and Mr. Souther's point is a good one. I think that if you would send, a panel of like five random experts to go survey 100 people, they would have agreement about whether or not these people are eligible and should be sent through the system in probably 95% of the cases. I mean, one of the things that we were trying to do with the public defender is to figure out, you know, what is the pattern of the people that go to the MDT and what is the pattern of the people that the MDT certifies. And there are so many people that are eligible under statute that we know right away will never, ever get referred, that the county attorney won't even refer them, and that they wouldn't make it through the MDT. And if there was some pre-screening process, somebody could go and speak to this person for an hour or look at his file for an hour. I'd prefer them not to speak to them, but, you know, have them go look at the file for an hour. They could figure this out really, really quickly, and it would dramatically speed up the process. It would make it much more efficient because I think, you know, Michael and I have done a case together, and I've helped one of the people that he helped get up to speed on these cases. I've done a case with her, and, you know, there's really not a whole lot of disagreement on the vast majority of the people in these situations. The law makes so many people eligible, and yet so few people end up fitting
actually
the criteria.
Wind up in the case. Right. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's get a call now. Ann is calling from Concord. Hi, Ann. You're on the exchange.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well.
A couple of items, I guess, to speak about is I worked at the secure psychiatric unit for many years in the 90s and also dealt with people that were not inmates. They were civil commitments. And the same thing applied to them. They would have the five-year review and then see if they would go on further. So it sounds like this is similar to that, except it's specific for sexual predators. My one concern is the multidisciplinary team. I've heard that it's either a forensic psychiatrist or, and or psychologist, is security on there as well? Are the correctional officers, the higher-ups on there? And is nursing on there? Are social workers on there? Who else is making this determination? That's one question. The second one is when they talk about mental abnormalities and they're using the DSM-4, which we currently use, does it specifically have to be sexual, or do they have to have like a serious and persistent mental illness along with it? Because I would think that would, I'm not sure that that's a good thing. I think it would have to be that consistently they were diagnosed with a sexual component. And then lastly, how is SPU going to house these people? Because when I worked there, it was way overloaded, and they've gone through changes where they have now inmates in a residential transitional unit. So they would really have to revamp that.
A lot of big questions there, and thank you for the call, Anne. Let me start with you, Anne Rice, because a lot of these go to the nature of the law as it's written. So let's start with that. You were shaking your head when Anne was asking about, are there security people on the multidisciplinary team, or are there nurses that are also part of that? It sounds like it's a team of psychologists and people who are evaluating rather than necessarily people who have experience with that individual.
That's correct.
Inside corrections.
The members of the team are Jeff Souther and the two forensic psychologists. The team does get records from the Department of Corrections that they can review so that there would be input in terms of written documentation about how the person has done while incarcerated. But in terms of actual participation, not at the time of the multidisciplinary review team. It may be that the prosecutors consult with prison treatment team folks during the process of evaluating the case or preparing.
Michael Valentine, she mentioned the idea of perhaps underlying mental illnesses, and but she also mentioned that there, you know, this is a category of sexual crimes. And I think it is worth pointing out that we seem to be treating certain kinds of sexual crimes differently than we do any other kinds of crimes, even very violent crimes. And how has that come about?
Well, I don't think that's completely true, Brady, because we have a system, and we have for years. I think the first civil commitment law that the Supreme Court cited was in 1778 and committed the furiously mad. So we do have these parallel processes for people who are dangerous in other contexts, including criminal context, where they're found not guilty by reason of insanity or where they're found to be not competent to stand trial, but they're dangerous. And they have a very similar kind of parallel process. They can be committed for up to 5 years. There has to be a new process at the end of that 5 years to continue their commitment. They're held for treatment. So it really is a very similar to process to those that we've used in this state for lots of other reasons. The sexual component of the act in this case is just a recognition that some people have illnesses that cause them to act out sexually. And I think it's a recognition that the damage and the injury to the people who end up being victims of these individuals is really serious. And it deserves its own recognition that these people, it's a very difficult condition in many situations to treat. We don't treat it in the same way that we treat a lot of other mental health illnesses. So it's not usually something that a person can just get medication or counseling or something where that may be a way of treating even something as serious as schizophrenia. Often medication will balance that. There is no medication that we have that makes someone not a pedophile. So it's the diagnoses tend to be sexually related, but it even if it's not, it could be bipolar or some other sort of illness. If the manifestation of that illness is to cause them to be prone to commit sexual offenses.
Tony Scalambrini, does it make sense then in some cases to say, look, this is someone we're going to have to keep in a secure facility for a while longer to see how this plays out?
I think that it probably does, and there are certain individuals that are exceedingly rare that it probably does make sense to do that for. But one thing I want to just push back a little bit on what Michael said was that these laws, like the furiously mad laws and the laws in the 1930s, the sexual psychopath laws, The difference in this case is that it is not explicitly linked to mental illness. The statute says mental abnormality, and that is because the statute that New Hampshire statute is based on came out of a Kansas case, and the U.S. Supreme Court approved that statute. And so New Hampshire statute very closely parallels that. But there's a distinction that's important. You know, it used to be under this law that they had to disprove that the person could be committed under one of these other civil commitment provisions. They don't have to do that anymore. And the issue that we have going forward in these cases is that mental abnormality is not a psychological or a psychiatric term. It's not something you will find in the DSM-4. Mental abnormality includes mental illness, but it is not the same as mental illness. There are things that aren't conceived of as mental illnesses that could count as mental abnormalities. You know, like one of the problems that comes up is, what do you do with somebody who has, you know, like the classic issue is antisocial personality disorder. You know, antisocial personality disorder is in the DSM-4 and it is a personality disorder, but it's not a mental illness in the same way that like schizophrenia is, because antisocial personality disorder comes out of a person's history. It's somebody who, you know, repeatedly shows no respect for laws or repeatedly shows, no respect for sort of social settings or contexts like that. And by having this, you know, sort of generic definition of mental abnormality, it means that the law is not as precise as those other laws. And it means that the lineage that the state is saying that these came out of these old laws, it's not exactly the same. You know, mental abnormality is a legal term. If you look at the cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, if you look at the cases around the country that deal with this, mental abnormality is a legal creation. You're not going to hear a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a doctor say, this guy has a mental abnormality. They may say he has a mental illness, and the distinction is important. People with antisocial personality disorder may or may not have any sort of sexual acting out. They may have had a sex offense in the past, and then they were, you know, for lack of a better term, they were, you know, kind of a jerk in prison. They get labeled with this antisocial personality disorder tag, and then they're eligible for this statute. Because there is no, as the caller noted, or asked about, there's no explicit tie between a sexual mental illness or mental abnormality and these charges. You could have somebody that has a completely unrelated, somebody has bipolar or alcoholism or antisocial personality disorder, and they could also be committed under this law.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll pick up with more on this discussion of New Hampshire's predator laws. And we'd like to hear from you as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. More after a break. This is The Exchange.
It's 9:39, and you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from the Stroke Program of Catholic Medical Center, a comprehensive stroke program dedicated to improving recovery rates for stroke patients. Information at catholicmedicalcenter.org. And from Rath Young and Pignatelli, with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston. National impact, uniquely New Hampshire, on the web at rathlaw.com. This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:40.
I think our mission is we try every day to find the stories that really matter to people living in New Hampshire.
That's Sarah Ashworth, news director here at NHPR.
And to tell the stories that other media outlets can't tell about New Hampshire. We have a forum that lets us go a little bit deeper, have a little bit more time to tell a story. So we try to take advantage of that and find the right stories.
Stay tuned to NHPR every day for those stories from our newsroom, or check them out online at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with guest host Sarah Ashworth from our newsroom. Email us your questions at nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today on The Exchange, we're taking another look at New Hampshire's predator laws. While many applauded the 2007 law, which allows offenders to be held past their sentences, others point out the law's flaws, and we'd like to hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest for the hour, Ann Rice, Deputy Attorney General for New Hampshire. Tony Scalambrini, New Hampshire public defender, typically defending inmates facing civil commitment in New Hampshire. And Michael Valentine, a prosecutor in Hillsborough County who handles civil commitment cases. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We've talked throughout the hour about how this law plays out differently in different states. And of course, New Hampshire's law, I believe, Anne Rice, was modeled at least partly off of a law in Kansas. Do other states handle civil commitment issues differently? And are there any lessons that we might learn from their experiences?
Well, one of the differences that both Tony and Michael spoke about earlier, I believe, was the pre-screening at the Department of Corrections. So there are some states that will have some people in the Department of Corrections where the offenders are housed do some sort of an evaluation before it gets referred anywhere for an evaluation by a multidisciplinary team or something like that. Another one, a significant difference in our statute and many other statutes, is that many states allow for discharged or conditional discharge from incarceration from custody if the person has shown some progress in treatment. Our statute talks about a 5-year commitment, and then a person can be recommitted after 5 years. It doesn't have, at this point, any provision for a conditional discharge or any type of transition during that 5-year period.
Does that is that something that you might find useful as in your work as a prosecutor, Michael, that right now you have kind of one option, civil commitment for up to 5 years or not?
It would give us a lot more options. As criminal prosecutors, as Tony said earlier, we often engage in plea negotiations. And it's something that the judge still has to sign off on. The judge always has final authority on a plea negotiation. But the parties are able to work out some specific terms. Maybe instead of jail time, we do community service. Maybe instead of probation, the person does some treatment or evaluations. In this context, it's all or nothing at this point. The person is committed for up to 5 years, or they're not committed at all. And that has led both prosecutors and defense to try to find some creative ways to resolve some cases where they think, where we think we can get some of those objectives met. So we think a person really might need supervision, but not necessarily in the secure psychiatric unit. We have done things like have the person plead to a new crime or extend or amend their sentence that they're currently serving to allow them to get placed on parole or probation, serving an additional sentence and still under that kind of supervision. Maybe they're required to do treatment and check in, but it's not necessarily the full commitment at the secure psychiatric unit. And this kind of actually brings back in also what Anne of Concord said earlier, that a bed at SPIU is very expensive and they're very limited. So if we had committed even, I think, 8 or 10 people over the last few years, which is what would have been expected, we would have probably maxed out SPIU already. And so having an option where we could negotiate a case and say, listen, to the public defender, we say, listen, this person really needs supervision and treatment, but we don't necessarily want to keep them confined at SPIU. Would the person agree to this kind of conditional discharge? Would they agree to additional treatment? Would they agree to additional supervision? That would give us some more options to resolve cases.
Tony, would you like to see more flexibility in this law as it's written now?
I think the law does need a little bit of flexibility. The one thing that I would note is In Manchester Superior Court, Judge Brown was sitting on a case, and he looked at the rules for civil cases, because that's one thing that I think people might not understand. Even though these people have been charged with a crime and have served their time, these are civil cases, so all the civil rules apply. You don't have the same constitutional rights. Judge Brown looked at the civil rules, and he kind of figured out that these are complex cases, and so under the civil rules of procedure in New Hampshire, they have to go through mediation. And so his notion that he sort of put together from the way that the rules are written for court was these cases should go to mediation and see what happens. And they have started to do that, and that has introduced a degree of flexibility that has really been quite helpful. I mean, one of the things that people need to understand about these cases is that from the state side and from the defense side, they are incredibly time-consuming, and they are staggeringly expensive. I mean, these are just monstrously expensive cases to go to trial. If you go to trial, you know, Michael and I did a trial, the first trial, and it lasted a week. We got our own jury pool, not our own jury, the entire pool, like all 200 people came in just for that case. Yeah, and it was really expensive. They're all experts. All the testimony, or most of the testimony, is provided by experts. And if anybody knows anything about civil litigation, experts are expensive. They charge you, you know, $250 an hour to chat on the phone. So these are incredibly complex cases, and by introducing that mediation idea, it's provided some sort of middle ground.
Michael.
I think that's very true. And I would say that the difficulty from the prosecutor's perspective with the way the law is written is that we have kind of been forced to come up with creative ways. When the judges have said, listen, go mediate this, my response to the judge has often been, listen, judge, I don't have any authority to do what the public defenders may want in this case. They want a special facility, or they want the person to get some sort of special treatment. And I say, the statute says spew or nothing, or it essentially says that. And I can't bind the Department of Corrections to contract with a different facility or put them in some other location other than spew, because that's not what the statute calls for. So even though the court has forced us to mediate many cases, it's kind of been a difficult responsibility from my perspective, because we have to, if we're going to mediate and resolve it, it almost has to be outside of that sexually violent predator designation, the commitment designation. It has to be an amendment to a criminal sentence or a new criminal sentence or some kind of creative resolution other than the civil commitment process.
Anne Rice, I wanted to come back to something that we talked about a moment ago, that Tony mentioned, that these cases can be highly expensive, and in either direction, that housing someone in dispute, which we should point out is the secure psychiatric unit, can be expensive, but so also can bringing a case of civil commitments. And if that's being done at the county attorney's office in an era where budgets are, there's not a lot of wiggle room in there, then sometimes that raises a lot of difficult questions for people about making decisions.
I think that it does raise a lot of difficult questions, and I know that there are some counties that will look at cases and maybe not bring them because of the financial aspects of it. They are so expensive. The reason that it was placed in the county attorney's offices originally was because the county attorneys are the prosecutorial arm of the state that does the actual prosecution of sexual assaults. And so the types of crimes that are being dealt with or focused on in the Sexually Violent Predator Act are those that are being prosecuted by the county attorneys. So there was a sense that the county attorneys would be familiar with the people, the crimes, and the background. So that's why it was placed there.
Let's take a call from our listeners. Well, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Aaron is calling from Concord. Hi, Aaron. You're on the exchange.
Hey there. How are you doing today?
Very well.
Well, I just wanted had an idea. Maybe my brother right now is in federal prison, and when he was sentenced to 15 years with 5 years of supervision after that. And I was just wondering, why couldn't we do something like that with sexual predators so that they can serve their full sentence, and then we still have that security of having them supervised while they're out in public, yet we're not infringing so much on their civil liberties or forcing them to be incarcerated even after they've supposedly paid their due to society.
And just Tony, it sounds like that it comes back to the idea that in current law, that's simply not necessarily an option.
That's right. And I would point out to the caller, to Aaron, that one of the things that happens in these mediation cases is that is often the result, that we, as Michael mentioned, you know, we amend a sentence or there is a new charge brought to allow the state to have some sort of supervision over this individual after they serve their sentence. Aaron's point also brings up something else. There are different models in the different parts of the country. You know, Texas's sexually violent predator law has a lot of people that are out in the community. Prior to doing some of these cases, I spoke with a gentleman who ran a program in Oregon, and he, over a period of 10 or so years, supervised 3,000 of the worst of the worst sexual offenders in Oregon, and through a combination of good community supervision and, you know, supervision guided by treatment ends and counseling, he was able to have those 3,000 guys pass through his system with a rate of reoffense of less than 1%. So like 0.5% was the rate of reoffense Dr. Woolert was getting in his Oregon program. And while the rate of reoffense for these guys is low, generally, much lower than most criminal defendants and much lower than people think, that rate of 0.5% is staggeringly low. I mean, it's off the charts low. There's nothing like that. And I think that if the statute was amended to have something like that, we might see more success.
Aaron, thanks so much for that call. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Michael Valentine, I wanted to ask you, since we're working with a law that was written in 2007, and that means that it was based on our understanding of sexual predators in 2007. And of course, research is ongoing. The way that we understand the nature of mental abnormalities is changing, and our understanding of how we may evaluate somebody is changing. Is it necessary to re-look at these laws from time to time and then make changes based on that?
I think that's always worth doing, and especially in a fairly complicated system like a sexually violent predator civil commitment. And we've already discussed a few things that could happen. Obviously, the ability to have some flexibility in terms of sentencing, the ability to have some pre-screening so that that burden isn't placed on the county attorneys. And quite frankly, I hate as the to sound like the typical public employee, but of course, the difficulty in these cases is always the funding. And I think the legislature passed this without really appreciating how difficult these cases might be and the burdens that are placed on the county. And reconsidering sort of some of the where those resources are allocated and how these people are treated, where they're prosecuted. I'm probably going to get a glare from Ann when I say this, but we have long said in the county attorney's offices that the attorney general's office, kind of like the homicides, should take the civil commitment. The sexually violent predator civil commitments, because it's a fairly unique and focused kind of litigation, and they could do it all over the state. Then it wouldn't place the burden on a COAS county who might have one or two prosecutors in the office to do this complex litigation. So it is worth something that is worth both the legislature and the attorney general's office taking a look at and focusing on how do we really want to go forward. Is it playing out the way we want it to? And if it's not, how do we improve it?
So, Ann Rice, I notice you're not glaring, by the way, but also, I mean, that's an important point that in some of these county attorney offices, it's not simply a matter of cost, but it's also a matter of resources, human resources. There may not be enough people to deal with the regular caseload and then also deal with a civil commitment case at the same time.
I think I don't disagree necessarily with Michael that it would be helpful to have a team that regularly did these kinds of cases. That's how the public defender's office is set up.
We don't do that.
Oh, I beg your pardon. No. I thought
it was, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. But we just, for the same reason, they can't. We can't.
Lost my train of thought there. I apologize.
Tony, what else would you like to see potentially changing as this law goes forward? We talked about a few things that...
One of the things that I think that the law could change is not necessarily in the law, but in the way these cases go forward, is the use of these actuarial instruments. For lack of a better test, for lack of a better word, they're just risk tests. How likely is this person to reoffend in the future? And one of the things that's happened is that the science has changed, as you'd mentioned. For example, all of these tests are based on this notion that if a person looks like somebody that's reoffended, that we've known has reoffended, they're likely to reoffend too. So it's sort of these people are correlated to each other. But what would be better is if we had some understanding of the scientific explanation for what causes these things. You know, like, if you have depression, they know that there's a problem with serotonin in your brain. What causes these things would give us a better indication of who's likely to reoffend. And that science is just not being done. Right now, we're under the correlation model. What we need to do is we need to move to a causation model with the science in this area. And it's just not happening.
Let's take one more call. Dawn is calling from Plymouth. Hi, Dawn. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning. I used to work at a facility, a school, not-for-profit school, that dealt with teenage boys that had huge issues, and many of them were sexual offenders of some kind. I'm wondering about the recidivism rate they said was so low in that one program that certainly that's something that needs to be looked at. The other thing is the cost. We're talking about the cost being so high in some of these cases, and I'm wondering what percentage of the total budget. I don't know if it comes from the prison system budget or social services budget or whichever budget it comes from, but what kind of percentage of the budget is that? Because it could be extraordinarily expensive per case, but someone also mentioned that it was a very small number of actual cases.
Do we know that, Ann Rice, about where the money comes from in the state budget, and then also do we know roughly how much the civil commitment winds up costing the state?
The money for the incarceration, the at the secure psychiatric unit is in the state budget. The money for the actual prosecution comes through the county budgets. I don't have figures on that.
And I'm afraid I don't either. I didn't ask my boss before I came up here for the specific sheets, but I can tell you that it's not a huge percentage. It's a large number when the county commissioners want to eliminate and reduce funding. It's an easy target to try to reduce, but it's not just looking at it by itself, it's not a huge percentage of the budget.
Don, thank you so much for that call. And there's so many more questions that I would love to ask each of you, but we're starting to run out of time. Let me just briefly ask you each. We talked about the changes that you'd each like to see. How much appetite do you think there is among lawmakers right now to revisit this issue? And I'll start with you, Tony, very briefly.
Briefly, I think that the better that we do at figuring out who to monitor, the cheaper this will be and the safer people will be. You know, we only have a finite amount of resources. And so what we need to do is we need to focus on only those people we really need to monitor.
Michael Valentine.
And I'm going to echo the sentiments of resources. Obviously, it's something that we want to do the law right if we're going to do it. And so if it's going to sit on the books, it needs to be something that both the prosecutors and the defense, quite frankly, but the state has the resources to devote to it.
And Anne Rice.
I think that the legislature would be willing to look at this, although the numbers are so small right now that I don't think there's a real drive to do it.
Well, I want to say a big thank you to each of you for coming in and joining us for the show today.
Thank you.
Anne Rice is Deputy Attorney General for New Hampshire. Tony Scalambrini is a New Hampshire public defender who typically defends inmates facing civil commitment in New Hampshire. Michael Valentine, a prosecutor in Hillsborough County who handles civil commitment cases. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern, Faith Mike.